What's up, everybody? You're listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
We're back again for another fantastic episode looking at what's happening here in Chicago in terms of film. Connor, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Tom.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, you got a nice beard going. I know podcasts are a visual medium, so it's important to describe.
Yeah, no, I've even decided to grow out my hair so that people can hear it a little bit in the tone of my voice.
It's good.
Yeah,
it's real working. Good.
It's very rock and roll.
Thank you.
I can hear it and I can feel it.
Exactly. And he's got a nice hair ahead. I haven't even introduced
him. He's got a nice hair ahead. I've always
he's got a hair ahead.
I never wanted to be that guy who got one haircut in high school and just stuck with it.
No. Just change it, arrange it. As you can hear, there's a third person in the room. It's not an apparition or some sort of
phantasm.
It is assistant editor for Daily Grindhouse, Mike Vanderbilt. What's up, man?
Hey, how are you guys? Thanks for having me back. I was on here last time talking about Cinepocalypse. I couldn't have offended anybody too harshly on that.
No way.
Only lightly.
Thank you.
you're a man of opinions and opinions that I like to read.
Well, I honestly do appreciate you reading them, because like when you're writing for a site that's relatively well known like Daily Grindhouse, you kind of wonder if, well, I'm putting it out there. I mean, I enjoy doing it, but is anybody actually reading this stuff?
Well, it's all about the game of clicks now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's all about the clicks. And you know, though, if you don't put out a really incendiary opinion, you're probably not going to hear from anybody. You're not going to know if they're reading, you know? Like, if I had, like, we were talking before we went to air, we won't get into this, we were talking about my Last Jedi review, if I had just panned it, as many people thought I did, I would have heard about it. Like, people would have responded on Twitter.
Right.
But since I kind of gave it a middling, yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, nobody wants to fight with you on it.
Which is too bad, because it's those kind of middle-of-the-roads opinions sometimes where you can find a lot more nuance to the opinion. Because, like, when you watch a movie, most of the time when I see a movie, even if I didn't love it, or, you know, if I'm somewhere in the middle about it, I like some things, didn't like some things, I think that's a better review than gushing about it or just completely throwing it to the dogs, because you're going to get something that you might... You know, you might see the bits that, oh, wow, I would probably really like this movie because it has some things that I like, and these things that he didn't like or she didn't like don't really matter so much. So I appreciate you taking the nuanced approach to film.
I have said that it's harder to it's hard to write about something you really like, and it's hard to write about something that you really hate.
Mm-hmm.
Because it can become all emotion in it. And somebody who, my favorite film critic growing up, I'm from Chicago, of course, it was Roger Ebert.
Bingo.
And I would read his book. Like, even like, you know, as a horror kid, and I disagreed with his review of Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors, but I read it and understood where his opinions came from, and
exactly.
I think that influenced and inspired me as someone who loved film at a young age and now writes about him.
Well, we appreciate you, and we appreciate Daily Grindhouse for giving us all of our B-movie genre needs and giving us the informed opinions. Bingo. And speaking of which, we've got some fantastic screenings coming up that Daily Grindhouse is a part of. It's you guys, the AV Club, and then also the Front Row. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening over at the Music Box?
So over at the Music Box in 2018, for three consecutive weekends, Daily Grindhouse, the AV Club, and Front Row, as you said, are putting on three midnight screenings, both the Friday and Saturday, of three bonkers cult classics. Some of which, I mean, I'm not the gatekeeper when it comes to cult cinema, but you may have seen them, you may not have, but either way, all three of these movies are worth going to check out. Even if you've seen them before, go to check out with a willing midnight audience. And we've got Wild Beasts, an Italian When Animals Attack style film from 1984. And then the following weekend, we have my personal favorite of the bunch, the one I personally curated. And it's worth mentioning that we got these are not being shown on 35mm, they're being shown on DCP that we arranged through the American Genre Film Archive, who are doing the Lord's work down in Austin, remastering and restoring these films to their, probably better than they ever looked, even in their original release.
I believe it.
And then we have The Astrologer from 1975, which has a very interesting story that we'll get into later, and Stray Cat Rock Sex Hunter, part of the Stray Cat Rock or Alley Cat Rock series from Japan from the 60s and 70s.
I just, by name alone, yeah, these are simply must-see.
Oh, it's the Stray Cat Rock.
Nothing to do with Brian Setzer. Nothing to do with beating the Stray Cats to the punch by about a decade.
So let's start with Wild Beast. That's coming up on 26th and 27th at midnight. You said it's an Italian When Animals Attack film. Is that like a subgenre?
Okay, so the When Animals Attack subgenre, if I was going to pinpoint a moment in history where it started, or I like the favorite thing of mine to do at Daily Grind is just add exploitation to the end of anything. Star Wars ripoffs, which were a big thing post-1977, I call that Lucasploitation. Or like this new glut of, you know, it used to be just guys, but now like this new glut of like a movies that feature a kind of almost superhero style antagonist killing a lot of people on screen, like Proud Mary or any Liam Neeson movie could be considered like Wixploitation or Neesonsploitation. Like one movie comes out and it inspires every other filmmaker, be it from the low budget to the bigger budget even these days, to kind of rip it off in a way or put its own spin on it. So When Animals Attack, I mean, let's face it, it's Jaws. 1975, Jaws comes out. There's a whole slew of Jaws-sploitation movies where it's animals in water attacking people. But then there was a whole other thing. We had snakes with Jaws of Satan or Venom. I'm terrified of snakes, so I love those movies again. And Rattlers. And then you had like the Jaws ripoffs like Piranha or Orca or White Shark.
Wait, they did an Orca?
Oh, you never seen Orca?
No. Is that like Shamu?
Yes.
But it's like Shamu. But it's a killer whale.
I like to think of it as a prequel to the Blackfish, the documentary about SeaWorld.
Wow.
The killer whale.
So there's a reason.
Yeah,
there's a reason that it's captivity.
There's a reason that that Blackfish happened. Orca has a relatively well-known cast, too. I want to say it was John Huston and Bo Derek.
You're kidding me.
And then you also had Grizzly, the killer bear movie. I think there was a movie, Day of the Animals, I think that was.
I recall seeing this one When Animals Attack movie. It might have also been Italian, where they used like actual lions and people like got hurt. I can't remember.
That's Roar.
Roar, okay.
That could be considered part of the When Animals Attack. Of course, that's borderline a documentary. Like that was about, it was a famous... It's a famous celebrity family like that grew up in this house with
just wild lions.
Real lions. Yeah. And Roar was a movie that was made in the house, and it has a narrative, but if you watch it, it's obvious that people were in relative danger at points throughout the film.
What's the deal with the naming structure of these When Animals Attack movies? It's one word that describes either what just describes the type of animal that's attacking.
Or what it's doing.
Roar, Orca, Jaws.
Well, it all comes from Jaws. Like, Jaws had a simple one-word title, and they want Alligator. Alligator is one of my favorites.
There's just a movie called Alligator?
It's from 1980. It's written by John Sayles. Like, John Sayles, most people know him as, you know, the... one of the fathers of independent cinema, or at least a luminary. But he made his money like writing trash. He wrote Alligator. He wrote Piranha.
Nice.
He was attached to a Django reboot a couple years ago that I don't think ever got off the ground. But yeah, John Sayles also did Brother from Another Planet and Lone Star, and his 80s output is legendary. But yeah, but when you watch him in interviews, he never looks down on the trash.
No,
and when you watch his trashier movie, like let's say Piranha or Alligator, there's a lot of nuance to it. They're very sharp. They're very sharp. Alligator is absolutely worth watching, and A Chicago Connection is set partially in Chicago.
Oh my! Where alligators roam?
Yeah. Well, because it was based on, and a lot of it's based on myth too. Like alligators based on the myth of people would win alligators at carnivals. And flush them down the toilet.
Oh, wow.
And then they would live in the sewers.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And it's Robert Forster versus the alligator in this movie.
Oh, my God.
So would you say that this Wild Beasts movie is a part of the... You would throw it into like a Spielsploitation kind of...
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Except it's about 10 years late, because it's 10 years after Jaws. But... And it's Italian, so it's...
it's very low budget and very grimy. And although there is a disclaimer at the opening of the film that no animals were harmed in the making of this film, I suppose I should let people know that the opening is relatively is pretty gruesome.
Yeah,
this movie, you do see animals getting killed. I don't believe it's real, but
it very well,
when you're first time I was watching, I was like, that looks like it might be real, man. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about watching.
It's kind of like that moment in Friday the 13th when they cut up the snake.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, that's definitely real.
Oh, they
it
killed,
was. That, they killed, yeah, that snake.
They absolutely killed that. At least we know what's for dinner.
Yeah.
Right? That's the... So Wild Beasts is bonkers. What I love about Wild Beasts is that sometimes a movie like this, an exploitation movie like this, might have a great poster and a great name and all of that, but maybe the payoff doesn't come until the end of the movie. Maybe there's only one great scene. That's a problem with a lot of exploitation and drive-in cinema, I-fi, or at least not a problem, but an issue. Like, it takes a long time to get going, and right, a lot of them are only remembered for one moment. Wild Beast gives you exactly what you want. It opens up with a quote. Allow me to read this quote. "Our madness engulfs everything and infects innocent victims, such as children or animals, and it's credited to Francis Thrive." Who's Francis Thrive, you may ask? I mean, if you guys did any research, you'll find out he didn't exist. That's a quote from the director. He opened up his own movie with a quote from himself.
That's awesome. And then it just animals just start dying.
Well, because the story goes, I mean, it's also kind of a PSA about the dangers of not only keeping animals captive, but PCP. Because the animals drink PCP-laced water that gets into the zoo, and then they start turning on people. And so you get killer rats.
Okay.
You get killer elephants. You get killer lions. And it's all very gruesome. It's very Italian. It's very bloody. And it's just, I mean, you talk about a movie that... So something when we do these midnight screenings with the Front Row, and something the Front Row, and as well as us at Daily Grindhouse, we encourage you to go and enjoy the movie. This isn't Riff Tracks. This isn't Mystery Science Theater, and you're not as clever as any of those writers.
Right.
So don't come to make fun of the movie, but we also don't want you to be quiet. We want you to enjoy it. Scream, holler, hoot, yell, yeah, have a couple cocktails. It's a movie called Wild Beast.
Yeah.
Treat it with just as much reverence as you need to treat it with.
Sure.
Have fun with it, because these movies are fun. And yeah, that's why we're showing them at midnight and not 11 a.m. on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I mean, you can't bring the kids, maybe. Bring them to the matinee.
Oh, the kids would run screaming as soon as they saw the God. First animal killed. And this one,
I love that this is an Italian morality play on the dangers of PCP. I do like the fact. Something I find funny about Italian cinema is the way that they filter American genre through themselves. I mean, that's how you get the spaghetti western, which more or less redefined the western. Absolutely. For the better. Can you talk a little bit about the Italian sense? Built like taking something like Jaws and filtering it through this, I guess, foreign, for lack of a better word, this kind of different cultural sensibility, and getting a different product altogether.
The thing that I always notice of particularly the Italian knockoffs, and they're always infinitely sleazier.
Yeah, they really like the blood and
yeah,
mud and everything.
Yeah, and there's always a lot more nudity. And it always feels much more transgressive, which is something I like about it. Like something like Wild Beast, you almost feel like you shouldn't be watching this.
You have to get it in a brown paper bag from the video store.
Well, yeah, like back in the old days of like tape trading, before you had great companies like Vinegar Syndrome and Arrow and Shout Factory, you know, and the American Genre Film Institute or Archive. Treating these movies with like the respect that we'd like to see them treated with, but you are kind of missing something when you had to go to Odd Obsession. Mm-hmm. And hey, what do you have that's weird? You would have a guy at the counter there, or a girl at the counter there, like, hey, I'm looking for a movie where, you know, an Italian animal's rip.
and they'd think about it, and they'd say, oh, yeah, let me. Yeah. And there's probably like three more other ones that I'm not even bringing up for this one. Like, this one, and this one. You know, these are the ones.
Give me all three.
Like, I grew up on the south side in Beverly, and I still live down that way. And there was two video stores, Popcorn Video and Village Video, that I frequented, that I would see the box art for a lot of these trashier movies, like the Ilsa movies. Are you familiar with the
Ilsa? Wolf of the SS?
Oh, yeah. Nazi exploitation, sexploitation stuff, and I was always, you know, without revealing too much about my personal proclivities, I was always kind of drawn to Diane Thorne on the cover of those movies. And I always thought to myself, especially now as an adult, like, who was renting those movies in my neighborhood? You know, who was renting all those flicks? And probably people like me who lived down there. The director of Wild Beasts has an interesting history because one of the first movies he worked on was the Mondo Cain shockumentary in 1962, okay. Which it became notorious because it featured, it was like Faces of Death. It featured real live, inhumane acts, and it's still not sure how much was real and how much was that. But one of the most interesting films, and this is what I just found out doing research in his repertoire, is a film called Goodbye, Uncle Tom.
Oh, my.
I saw this. I had read about it for years, and I saw it down at Fantastic Fest, introduced by Nicholas Winding Refn. And what's a fake documentary called? What do they call those now?
A mockumentary.
Mockumentary. Yeah. It's a mockumentary from 1972 that features a camera crew that goes back to Civil War times and does a documentary on slavery in the United States. Except it's strange because there's never any explanation to how they traveled through time with cameras to go do it.
They're just there.
It's just accepted. They're there, and there's no race against time to get, like, oh, we have to get to the helicopter before we're trapped here forever. It's just treated, I mean, relatively realistically, but it's just ill-advised. It's totally in bad taste. But if you're a connoisseur of bad cinema, I do recommend you kind of tracking out. And just to wonder, who let this happen?
Yeah, who in the right mind would make a movie called Goodbye, Uncle Tom?
I know.
Oh my God, I feel my face is red just thinking.
I know. I sat with a crowded room of people down at Fantastic Fest who were obviously very uncomfortable by the whole thing. There's always nervous laughter because it's more for me. Like, it's not funny because of the subject matter. It's funny to me that somebody thought this was a good idea.
Now, that was
a team of people had to think that this was at least serviceable.
Yeah, let's do this.
But that's exploitation cinema.
Yeah, that's true.
Going back to your original question, like, a lot of that was, you know what? People will be curious. This will put butts in the seats. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the bottom line with a lot of exploitation, while we treat it like art now, and there is a lot of artistry in it, it was money. It was like, let's put out a cheap product that can make money back. That's why that's why Sam Raimi and them, they would have probably been better off making comedies. They had more of a love of Three Stooges and horror movies, but they knew there was a return on investment for horror, which is why they made The Evil Dead.
So it's interesting that you bring up Nicholas Winding Refn at Fantastic Fest, because he also, in, what was it, 2014, introduced the next movie that will be showing, The Astrologer, which you mentioned there's kind of Tom and I both have done some reading on it, and it, to use a word that you've been using, it looks fucking bonkers.
It's bonkers. That's the only way you can describe The Astrologer. Now, you guys have not seen The Astrologer yet.
No.
Because one of the things I loved, when we were programming these three, myself in the front row and AV Club. So let me talk a little bit about how this whole thing came about before we get into The Astrologer.
Sure.
The front row was putting on a 70mm screening of Streets of Fire at the Music Box, and I saw this, and I always like to ride people's coattails and get my fingers in a bunch of pies, and I said, hey, I want Daily Grindhouse to sponsor this. Everybody on the site loves this movie. This is something we do. So I got involved with them through Ryan from the Music Box, and it turned out I knew Brian McKendry, who runs Front Row already. I'd met him before through Katie, who is our connect at AV Club, Katie Reif. So Katie and I went to the Friday night screening of Streets of Fire, and after we were walking out with McKendry and talk, we had a real good showing at Streets of Fire for a midnight movie. For, as we discussed before the podcast, before we started this podcast, for a relatively cultish hit, like, it was, it didn't sell out the big theater, but it filled it up. So we started talking about, like, you know, we'd like to bring more of our personal tastes to the music box, because there's so much going on in Los Angeles. I mean, before the whole Cine Family thing kind of went kaput, they had that. Austin, obviously, with Fantastic Fest, and the American Genre Film Archive is down there, and the home of the Alamo, even though they had their own problems as well.
Yep.
And New York is New York. There's always something going on in New York. Like, why can't Chicago be doing this stuff, too? And I love that the Music Box is showing midnight screenings of stuff like The Goonies and Hook and stuff that's really not of my generation.
Sure. But it's, like, cute. It's cool that it's, like, they're bringing people out to experience the midnight atmosphere.
Yeah, but that's not... Initially,
that's not the midnight movie,
atmosphere.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I mean, the ultimate one, I mean, the big one is Rocky Horror Picture Show, which, I mean, even that as transgress or as it wasn't transgress, subversive as it was in 75.
It's not like, so subversive anymore.
I was talking to some girls once, like they were talking to her, their dad introduced it to it. Their dad loved Rocky Horror, you know, and it's like, okay, so it's not as subversive anymore. So we got together and we said, well, let's pick three movies from the American Genre Film Archive. And Katie picked the one we'll talk about later, Stray Cat Rock. Brian McKendry and Bryce from the South Side chose Wild Beast. But when I looked at that list, I said, I want to bring The Astrologer to Chicago because The Astrologer, I believe, in my research, has only shown in Los Angeles and Austin. I will assume it probably showed in New York at one point. So this is
somewhere.
Definitely, I believe it's the first screening in Chicago. And what's so great about The Astrologer for me, like, the plot is secondary. A carny con man realizes he actually has psychic powers. And he uses them to his own means, to further his own agenda. But the story about it, that it's never going to it'll probably never receive an actual release because of the use of Moody Blues music
throughout the entire movie
that he never secured the rights for, that this is something really special.
And he would be Craig Denny,
right? The director. It was written by someone different. I don't have the name in the notes, but it's obviously his passion project, and you can tell that. And it reminds me a lot of The Room. When you watch it, here's what I love about like these bonkers passion projects, like something like The Room. You guys have seen The Room?
Yes.
Yeah. Which, you know, a lot of people know now, definitely know now because of the Disaster Artist. It's all about how awesome the person who's running the show is. The Room, every time somebody would be like, oh, you're my favorite customer, Johnny, and how everybody was just treating him bad. Everybody was going, it was obviously somebody messed with Tommy Wiseau at some point in his life, and he was putting it all on the paper.
Yeah, it's squarely from his perspective, the entire movie.
Absolutely. About how great he is and how everybody does him wrong and nobody understands him as an artist. You get that out of The Astrologer because it's just all about how great this guy is. And he goes on an adventure. Like, I mean, it's pre-indiesploitation because it's pre-Raiders of the Lost Ark, but it's kind of got that adventure kind of vibe, King Solomon's Mines kind of thing. And it also reminds me a lot of, did you guys see Dangerous Men? It was an Alamo Drafthouse hit, one of these kind of things that were thought to be lost to time. And Dangerous Men, the story with that is the guy started shooting in the 80s, ran out of money, and shot the rest of it in the 90s. So Fantastic Fest can be rough on you. And I will fully admit to, I took a little siesta in the middle of the movie, and I woke up and I wondered what the hell was going on because it was a completely different movie.
Oh,
because he didn't have the stars from the original half, so all of a sudden it just shifts gears into
to
this separate thing. And The Astrologer does that like 3 or 4 points throughout it, and you just have to see it to believe it. Like it sounds like some carny con man stuff on my end, but like if you're not getting out there on February 2nd and 3rd to see this, you're really missing out on something special.
Now, Nicholas Winding Refn, he described Craig Denny. He said that Greg Denny with The Astrologer took auteurism to a whole new level. What does that mean? What are we in store for when he means, you know, he took the auteur theory to a whole new level?
Well, he didn't write the movie, but it's the history of this whole thing is muddled
as they are,
which just adds to the mystique, which I love, that you're really watch. This is like The Room. This is Craig Denny synthesized into this movie. I don't want to say you've never seen anything like it, but it's bonkers. It's bizarre. Know, it's strange.
We watched the trailer, and you are literally right. I'm watching. I'm like, I don't think I've ever seen something of this caliber before, because it really stands on its own. Like, all of a sudden, he's going from location to location to location. He's in, like, Tahiti.
He goes into a Kenyan prison, yep. And he's in, like, a jewel cache guarded by poisonous cobras and he looks shit.
I like that part. I'm terrified of snakes.
I know, yeah.
That part. That,
and then there's
pull my feet up on the couch. You know?
And then there's a door that's space. He's just looking out into
the astral window.
Yeah, I really like the concept. I mean, you did say that the plot is kind of like that's not really the point. But
it's all secondary. It's the experience.
I do love the idea of just like a carny con man who's got psychic powers, and then it just completely jumps off the rails from there. I mean. And you said we'll never. This could be the only chance that anybody has to see it in the city of Chicago.
And
if you're going to watch this.
That's why I'm really pushing this because, one of my big reasons to want to bring this to Chicago is that even in cult film, there is a little bit of gatekeeping. And there is something to be said for something that's very hard to find. It was similarly with Oliver Reed in the. Ken Russell's The Devils, mm-hmm. which was very hard to find for a long time because it was I don't think it got an official release in the States, but it disappeared because kind of attacks religion. It's very mm-hmm. sacrilegious, and it was hard to find. So it was like one of those things where when you were talking to cinephiles, like, oh, but did you see The Devils?
Yeah.
And it was kind of like a cool, like, oh, yeah, I've seen that. I've seen it too, which I love that aspect of it. But I don't like that idea that, oh, well, if you haven't seen The Devils, then you're not a true cinephile. Like, you need to give people, cult film is for everybody. You need to give people the opportunity to see this. Like, yeah, I'm not going to send out, I can't give you a copy of Astrologer to watch in your home and make it that easy mm-hmm. on you, but I can program it for a midnight showing at the Music Box in Chicago.
Right.
And give you the opportunity. Like, it shouldn't be something, the Astrologer shouldn't be something that only people in LA and only people in Austin get to see. I want my people in Chicago to be able to see this so people can be at the bar or anything. And, there's going to be, I will, exclusive here. We'll be giving away pins at the showing, exclusive to the showing, that read, "You're not an astrologer, you're an asshole." So it'll be one of those things. Like, if you see somebody else around Chicago wearing that pin on their denim jacket, you're like, mm-hmm. I was at that screening too. Let's talk about The Astrologer. And, you know, it encourages people talking about movies, which I dig. It's something that I want to do with cult cinema. As somebody who, you know, had to track some of this stuff down as a young man through, you know, nefarious underground video rings.
Right.
And even in a world, and here's something else that I always bring up when I talk about The Astrologer and cult film in general, when I was a kid reading like Rec.Arts, that Laserdisc on the news groups on Prodigy Internet, I was an early adapter to the internet, and you'd read about these, like something like the spider walk scene from The Exorcist, which was fabled for years. Did they shoot it? Did they really shoot it? Nobody saw it. And then it finally came onto DVD, and even though it's not all that great, but that build-up, like, oh, I'm finally seeing something. You don't have that anymore, because now deleted scenes are part of the way you sell the Blu-ray. The Last Jedi, we already know we're getting a half hour of deleted scenes on that.
Yeah.
It's not like, for years, people wondering if they actually shoot Obi-Wan and Darth Vader's confrontation in Return of the Jedi, when he tells the story in the novelization. Did they shoot that? Or, like, the Biggs scenes in the original Star Wars, and you talk about it with friends and associates for years, and it becomes mythological. Like, The Astrologer's in a world where you can find anything on streaming, be a Shudder or via Amazon Prime. This is something that's still just a little bit out there that you can't find everywhere, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because we were thinking about this in the lead up to talking to you about this idea of what, and we read this great article on Birth Movie's death about the astrologer specifically and the death of the Secret Handshake movie. And I feel like you've hit a lot of those, like a lot of those same sentiments. I feel like
I've read that piece too. I mean, that's by Jacob Knight. You know, we're Twitter buds. I see the Fantastic Fest. I understand his sentiment. Yes.
Yeah, and but with what I wanted to say was specifically to your point about the streaming versus getting out and seeing the movie itself. So, Connor, you and I are subscribers to a number of
several streaming services.
And there's, I will say, it is incredibly convenient. Like, as much as I love going to midnight movies and everything like that, there is the incredible convenience of being like, oh wow, I just read this article about this about Battle Royale. I never saw Battle Royale.
And that's the thing about digital, right? Is it's at the best quality of digital is that it's comforting or that it's convenient.
Yeah, it's easy and convenient. But do you think that that you enjoy a movie more when you have to go kind of out of your way? I mean, I wouldn't call the Music Box exactly out of our way, and you have done a fantastic job doing the heavy lifting of it, which is securing the film. But do you think that people will enjoy the movie more going out to see it and saying, I'm going to go have an experience instead of like, I'm a member of a few torrent groups, I bet I can find a copy of this?
With something like The Astrologer, I would say, yeah, I mean, I would say you could enjoy it at home because it's weird. I mean, drugs help.
Yeah.
That's an official no-coast endorsement. Yeah.
I think there's something to be said for the experience of seeing something in a movie theater as well. I'll admit, sometimes when I'm watching a movie at home, even if it's something that's maybe not catching my interest right away, I'll play on my phone or I'll find a project around the house that I need to do. Like, it does happen. Not all the time. Sometimes, most times, a movie just completely captures me and brings me in. Whereas when you see it in the theater, like, if you have any manners, you're handcuffed and I'm just going to keep my phone in my pocket and you're watching it with this crowd of people, and sometimes the crowd can help you get into it. And that's a big part of the experience of the midnight movie, I think. I mean, Rocky Horror is the biggest example where people started dressing up as the characters and interacting with the screen. Mm-hmm. I think that is something that you can't really capture at home. Mm-hmm. My friends and I used to do a thing where when I wanted to catch up on a lot of the trashier side of cinema that I had never seen before, a lot of stuff's great to watch for yourself, but me and my friends would get together at my buddy's apartment who lived next door to me on Thursday nights, and everybody would bring something off Netflix. Mm-hmm. Something strange, something bizarre. Some people would bring very mainstream stuff, but I always appreciated it when we'd bring something out there that, if you were watching it by yourself, it might be okay, but if you're watching it with a group of people that appreciate that kind of trash, and you'll make the occasional crack or joke, and laughter's contagious when somebody starts laughing at something. I mean, back to the drug thing. I mean,
and that's why I'm really excited about this, and why I think Tom and I are both going to be going to at least the Astrologer showing in early February. And 2017 was a great year for me as a moviegoer, because I had sort of forgotten how great it can be to be in a theater full of people and have a really truly great and like community sentiment kind of, you know, watching experience.
Yes.
And that's what I'm really excited for with this. You liken it to The Room, and I've seen the videos of the people throwing spoons at the screen. So I'm really excited for sort of that kind of inclusive environment when I'm watching a movie that's just, what, like accidentally avant-garde?
Yeah, I mean, Craig Denny is not of this world anymore. He is transferred to the stars through
the great horoscope in the sky.
And so we don't know really what was going on with the making of this movie, but it's got a great, as I like to call it, something weird aesthetic. You guys familiar with Something Weird? It's a company that out of Seattle, started by Mike Verrini. His widow, Lisa Petrucci, runs it now. And did you guys see The Love Witch?
See The Love Witch.
Okay. I'm not.
So you know that bonkers. you know that aesthetic, that look?
Yeah, that it's so indescribable, but telling me that there is a company that kind of like that
they
makes
curate
sense.
That kind of movie. It's usually from the late 60s, early 70s, little bit psychedelic,
extremely overlit,
yeah,
like very soft.
Yeah, absolutely. And they do a lot. They put out a lot of movies like that. And I would say The Astrologer definitely fits in that something weird aesthetic.
Yeah, I do. It's so funny that you bring up The Love Witch, because that was one of my thoughts. I was like, wow, this looks like it has that specific quality to it that's just like or what was it we Project Nightmare had that kind. Have you ever seen Project Nightmare?
No, I haven't seen, but I believe, did you go, it was at the Comfort,
that was Comfort
Station
film. Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Paul from Daily Paul Frank from Daily Grindhouse. Let me stop and just say I love that he writes for Daily Grindhouse, because if he didn't write for Daily Grindhouse, I would be reading his stuff, because he seeks out the kind of weird that I love, that I don't like. You kind of feel like everything's been discovered. You've seen everything before,
right?
And then Paul finds something like he does. He did a rewatch of some Playboy series for our Softcore Week. This it was a series on Playboy TV that was like, I think it was serialized or anthology. But he went back and watched it, and like I said, treated it with just the amount of reverence that it needed to be treated with. And I love what he does, and I love what he does at Comfort Station with Raul and Nando.
Yeah, it was watching Project Nightmare. I feel like that was just dipping my toes into this idea of going and out and seeing a weird curated movie. And Connor and I both absolutely loved it.
Comfort Station's a great place to see that.
Exactly.
It is. Yeah, it was an arresting experience. That movie.
Well, and the thing that I really like about both what you're doing and what Conversations do and what screening series around the city are doing is that, one, it's providing a place for people to go out and have a good time, one.
Yes.
But also, I feel like we're building this relationship. Even say you and I were to never meet Mr. Vanderbilt, and I would go,
I don't want
to
live in that world. No. I don't want to live in that world.
But let's
this
pretend.
Dystopia.
But say I'm just, you know, average Joe. I'm walking by the music box and I say, oh, they're showing this crazy midnight movie. Oh, I haven't been to a midnight movie in years. And you go and you find out that it's been curated and that it's been chosen for it. It's almost like for you. It's like, look, this is going to be the building block of a cultural relationship we're going to have. And then you get to experience it and you walk out. And even if we don't ever get to talk, you feel like, wow, Mike Vanderbilt and Daily Grindhouse picked something for me and said, I think you're really going to like this. And that's why I like that idea of the secret handshake movie where now the buttons, the fact that there are going to be buttons, I'm freaking out.
Yeah. And one more exclusive that we're announcing today. Not only will there be buttons, we're going to have giveaways at the other two screenings. I haven't figured out what. I'm working on some weird stuff. I love the hucksterism. I love the William Castle-ness. I want to bring that back. I want to bring that back. Because you get these, like you said, with streaming services, you need to make these things an event. Mm-hmm. Like, people want to take their picture there, and they want to do things, which is why we will be featuring renowned astrologer, who is not an asshole, Vina LeVay, will be reading tarot for 2 hours before the astrologer screening, at least on a Friday night. I mean, I can't predict the future. She can. Possibly on the Saturday night.
So I can find out how good my crops are going to be this
absolutely.
Year.
Absolutely.
Or what my credit score is going to be in 2022.
It's going to suck. I can tell you that right now.
Oh, shit.
Well.
As someone who's dealing with credit card debt.
Oh, spoiler alert.
Yeah. But, so we're going to have a real live astrologer reading tarot in the music box, the lounge next door. So get there early. Movie starts at midnight, so I think about having her there about 10, maybe even 9, depending on what the demand is.
Well, I mean, that's what makes it the best part, is that you can get in there, like, I mean, as you were saying before, get your cocktail, get your future read, you know, and make this a thing. Before we run out of too much time,
yes,
I do want to step over to Stray Cat Rock or Alley Cat Rock, Sex Hunter. Please give me some sort of context here.
Is Sex Hunter like, there's like a colon in there or something?
It's
like
a title?
Okay, so this is
Sex Hunter.
This is a series of films that came out of Japan in the swinging 60s, early 70s, and they generally deal with girl gangs, violence.
A little bit faster, Pussycat, Kill Kill.
In that vein, yeah. It's definitely kind of an answer to the teenage delinquent movies of the from America in the States, but with that very distinct kind of Japanese style. So these are playing February 9th and 10th. Now, I am not the expert on these. This was definitely curated by Katie Reif of the AV Club. You can find her. She's the news editor and film critic over there. Excuse me. And she introduced me to these movies. I didn't know much about them, but it's about a gang of female hoodlums who take on a mob boss who is working in the sex trade. It's the third film of the Stray Cat Rock or Alley Cat Rock series. They're very psychedelic, very sexy. Now, you don't need to see all of the... need to see all of the other Stray Cat Rock movies. This is just kind of considered the favorite amongst a lot of experts in this particular subgenre. It was shot concurrently with another movie in the series called Stray Cat Rock Wild Jumbo. But the real trick, the thing about this movie that's worth going to see is if only for its star Miko Kaji.
That rings a bell.
I'll tell you why. She was an actress and singer, but she's perhaps best known for her starring role in 1973's Lady Snowblood.
That's it. Okay.
Are you guys Lady Snowblood fans?
I've never seen it. I have started working my way through it because I can't remember if it's Criterion or Arrow that has a Lady Snowblood set.
I think it's
Criterion.
Criterion had it.
Yeah, and I subscribed to the Filmstruck streaming service, and I was just like, this looks fucking awesome. I'm just going to start watching it. And so, wow, so she's in this.
Yes,
that's fantastic.
This is 3 years before Lady Snowblood. She was also in the female convict 701 Scorpion series,
which Arrow has a box set out.
People will listen to this and they'll hear about it if I'm wrong on this. I believe that's part of they're known as Pinky Violence movies, mm-hmm. which it's sex and violence, pink
sure.
because of genitalia.
Sure.
that's where it comes from. So it's 3 years before Lady Snowblood. She was a Japanese singer and actress. She is stunning. You can't take your eyes off her. And it's just so much great violence in this movie. There's a cool biography from Arrow Books about her by Tom Mess called Unchained Melody, the films of Miko Kaji. You can read an interview with him on Daily Grindhouse. We'll tweet that out. We'll share that.
Mm-hmm.
Katie describes her favorite scene in the film as how does she say it? Miko and her gang light up a party of would-be rapists with Molotov cocktails. So it's very it's very of the moment.
Yeah, naturally.
It's very of the moment. And that's what a lot of people like about these movies. They were very progressive.
Yeah. And isn't that strange in a certain sense where, you know, this is considered exploitation when you're back in the 60s and 70s, and now we're looking at these as, you know, as art, as something to be appreciated, as you said, with a certain amount of reverence, and there's something super timely about it, because it's like, with everything that happened last year with men in Hollywood, wouldn't it be nice to sit down and watch a group of female warriors burn down some dudes would-be rapists.
Yeah, girl gangs are very into zeitgeist now. Yeah. Like somebody on my Facebook bought candles for Bed Bath & Beyond that say girl gang on it.
Yeah.
So, hey,
bring it back.
Everybody who's into girl gangs, this is the movie to go see on February 9th and 10th. Miko Kaji eventually left the studio that made these movies because she refused to do nudity. They went straight softcore porn.
Right out,
And that's how she ended up doing Lady Snowblood, which just screened a couple weeks ago at, I don't know where, somewhere here in Chicago. I missed it. But it's got all that great Japanese bright red blood splatter.
Oh, yeah. It's weird to think of.
And you can see the influence on it in Kill Bill.
Right.
The climax of Kill Bill. And I remember watching Force Awakens, the lightsaber duel in the snow at the end.
Oh, yeah.
That's straight Lady Snowblood.
Yeah. And it's, speaking of that, I mean, with these movies, a lot of directors working today, I mean, the obvious choice is Quentin Tarantino, but then you get to guys like Refn, who did Drive, Neon Demon, all this great stuff, really drawing inspiration from genre film. He even, Mr. Refn said that he wanted to steal a scene from The Astrologer for the Neon Demon. And he's just like, I literally just want to take this scene and do it as a part of the Neon Demon. Why do you think these have such a lasting impact on directors of today?
It's fascinating to me because someone who grew up in the 80s and 90s where exploitation film was not held with any reference at all. Like, Fangoria horror movies, everything was kind of seen as low rent. Mm-hmm. Fangoria even had a very funny regular feature, and it was like this cartoon of a studio boss with the
big cigar
yeah. and the glasses and holding the film, and this is not a horror film. And it's where they would cover something like Silence of the Lambs or The Crush with Alicia Silverstone, because horror was just seen as low rent and you couldn't sell it. And that came up like this past year with like movies like Get Out and It, which kind of got critical raves, right. Which I don't know if they would have gotten critical raves 20, 30 years ago.
It's true.
And I'm of two minds of that sort of thing. Well, I love that there's big Hollywood directors, but you got to figure the big Hollywood directors that are influenced by these movies are my age. So they grew up on the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I was 14, 15, Quentin, it bears repeating. It's almost a cliche at this point, but Quentin Tarantino, as much as I was into horror and kung fu movies before him, reading about what influenced him inspired me to track down other exploitation cinema. And he kind of made it okay. He said to you at 14, 15, 16 years old, yeah, you can like all that trash, but you can also like the French New Wave and The Godfather,
sure,
and big Hollywood stuff and
right.
John Sayles movies. Like, you can just like movies. And not to say he invented that concept, but when you're 14, 15, 16, and you're is pre-internet where you feel like you live in this bubble world, but I like these both kinds of movies. And to find out that there's people out there like that, it's cool. And like, yeah, these directors are just people my age who maybe were inspired by Tarantino or other directors. And they're paying the reference to it that I'm paying to, too. So I love to see it. But on the other hand, it's also kind of like you do, like, talk about the Secret Handshake movie. You kind of
right,
like,
yeah.
Wait a minute, that used to be my thing. Everybody yeah. likes that now. And that's where you get kind of that fanboy nonsense.
A little bit, yeah.
Gatekeeper stuff. But you have to think about it, and that's something that I fight in myself, because cult film is for everybody.
And that's the sentiment I think we want to walk away with here, is get out to these movies, because cult film is for you, it's for your friends, it's for anybody
in
the city.
Your parents. I introduced my parents to this stuff. My parents my mom texted me last night to let me know that her and my dad watched Brawl in Cell Block 99, the new Vince Vaughn flick, which is total exploitation.
For sure.
Which my dad loved, and my mom's view was like, you could really hear the bones breaking.
Well, I still remember the first time I got my mom to watch Kill Bill, which is like Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2.
And did she like it?
She thought it was interesting. She was just like, this is what you watch. And I was just like, okay, yeah.
Well, I had a different upbringing than most people. Like, my sure. mom bought me Fangoria and Mad Magazine.
Wasn't
well,
that
a
lovely?
Kid. But she
family affair.
Lovely.
But now she can't watch. She can't watch horror movie. Like, she can't. Well, she can't watch Freddy Krueger movies because they give her nightmares. I'm trying to get her to watch Get Out. She's a little nervous about it. She's
oh, just tell her it's just like it. The Stepford Wives.
I said, yeah. I said it's like a good Twilight Zone episode. Yeah. She goes, I was terrified of the Twilight Zone.
Well, thank you so much, Mike.
Oh, thank you for having me back, guys. I love coming on here. This is great.
I'm going to go back through real quick in this schedule.
Absolutely.
Wild Beast, January 26th and 27th. Astrologer, February 2nd and 3rd, and then Stray Cat Rock Sex Hunter. That's going to be February 9th and 10th, all at the Music Box,
yes.
All at midnight. Show up. Before we go, I want to see if you can think of, I want to go around this little table we have.
Right.
What is your favorite midnight movie? What is your favorite midnight movie to show to people? And I if you want to say The Astrologer, you can, but if you got another
no,
one.
No. Like, it's a tough call because, like, what is a midnight? Like, strange. Okay, you know what? As far as, like, just strange movies that I kind of champion, Shriek of the Mutilated.
What is that about?
Shriek of the Mutilated.
Shriek of the Mutilated. It's from 72 to 73. It's a Yeti movie.
Okay.
And real low budget. Like, I mean, this would be what some people consider to be bad or poorly made, maybe. Maybe a little inept. Maybe a little offensive.
I'm seeing air quotes on. This is what you might
as
call
you know,
a movie that's poorly made or terrible.
It is gangbusters trash. And there is a twist that happens in the movie that I may have been intoxicated when I watched it for the first time. That I had to rewind it to make sure that I didn't dream it. Because it's just so bonkers and so out there, like, because the kind of movie you're expecting to get, that it makes it an infinitely better movie than the box or the poster art promises. Because so much of exploitation, it was a great box or a great poster art.
And
then you see it, and it's like I said, you know, the last 10 minutes are what you see it for. Shriek of the Mutilated is totally worth watching.
Shriek of the Mutilated.
That or Rocky Horror. I have a certain soft spot for Rocky Horror. Its sequel, Shock Treatment.
Yeah, see, that is one I only recently found out that there was a sequel to
There's Rocky Horror Picture. The music, I might like it better than Rocky Horror. I don't know.
Really?
And I don't know if that's me being contrarian or just somebody who has listened to the Shock Treatment and Rocky Horror soundtrack umpteenth times since the time I was 15 years old.
Does the second one retain any of the original cast?
Yes, in different roles.
Okay. Oh, really?
Bizarre.
That's interesting.
I like that. So I'm going to seek out Shock Treatment. Definitely.
It's very timely, too, because it kind of predates reality TV in a way. It's And the music's great, because the music's very... If Rocky Horror is very 50s-inspired, kind of 70s glam rock, this is very kind of 80s new wave.
Okay.
Yeah. Shock a lot of great tunes in it.
And now, are these readily available places, or am I going to have to track down a guy?
Shriek of the Mutilated is usually streaming for free on Amazon Prime.
Oh, okay.
Usually in a very in a shoddy copy that actually kind of adds to the aesthetic of it. Looks like it was taken off somebody's 16mm print in their basement. Shock Treatment, actually, Arrow Video put out a UK... I think it's a UK only, so if you have a non-region... player, which I've been meaning to get basically for this package of Shock Treatment.
But, go find that. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can find it on DVD, like cheap. And I don't think it's streaming anywhere, though.
All right. Connor, what do you got?
All right. So I'm going to go with Kung Pao, Enter the Fist.
Yes.
Natural.
I watched that movie. So I went on a vacation with my best friend when I was about 13. And
perfect age.
It was. And we watched that. We brought like four or five different movies to watch in the hotel. And we only watched Kung Pao. We never got to the other titles. We watched Kung Pao.
How many times did you watch it?
Once a day, at least, for an entire week straight. And to say that I was crying laughing doesn't really do justice to what was happening to me
I
watched.
That laugh where like you feel like you might die because you can't breathe.
Yeah, it's caught in there, and I can't... Nothing I can do is chipping away at that laugh. Like I can't say enough things about that movie. Steve Odenkirk. I'm not a huge fan of the thumb series,
which are great. Yeah. Thumbtanic.
And then, so, I don't know. There's something about Kung Pao which has me forever.
and great for a midnight audience. Like, anything like that, because it's bizarre.
Yeah.
And funny. And, like, and it's like, that's something like, with, like, something like The Astrologer, what I like about it. When it feels like it's from another dimension, which is why I love, like, something like Tim and Eric so much.
Yeah.
That it feels like there's another world that this came from.
Yeah. And that's got to be the thing.
I do want to throw one more on there, which is not a movie. You can't really find it anywhere. It's something that you can sort of hobble together. It's called Dear Reader, Wizard People, which is a retelling of the first Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone movie. It's got no music in it. It's a voiceover by comedian Brad Neely, who works for Adult Swim right now.
Okay.
And
I like their stuff.
He retools all of the characters. He gives them different names. He changes the genders of some of the characters.
Yeah.
He completely changes the story of the first Harry Potter movie around, and it is hysterical.
It's
really well written.
Yeah,
I love stuff like that. Like that game people play online, describe your favorite movie plot badly.
Yeah, exactly. And this is like almost a parody of an audiobook.
Yeah,
and it's just like if someone were reading Harry Potter to you, but also it's not Harry Potter at all. It just happens to be in the same cover.
It's the greatest fan fiction ever made.
Yeah,
it's like when your mom would buy you like, oh, I got you a Star Wars toy, and it's like Space Galaxy.
Yeah,
like,
is that a Spider-Man body with a you know Boba Fett head?
Yeah, like, exactly. Like, I guess this is Harry Potter. Like,
you wouldn't know different.
What's your movie?
I gotta say, so backstory in this, we and this is why I love so much the midnight movie thing and the secret handshake movie. Back when I was in like middle school going into high school, I started going to Wizard World Chicago over
in Rosemont. Yeah.
And those really formative for me and my friends. And the one thing we always made sure to do was, because we really weren't about the panels. We were there to just buy shit because we couldn't get it anywhere else. And in McHenry County, there was like one comic book store.
I used to go to the Weekend of Horrors when I was a kid, which was Fangoria's, and that's where I bought like the 95-minute version of Army of Darkness, which was on a muddy VHS tape.
Yeah.
And now you can get it for $6 at Walmart. Right.
And that's where you could go when you didn't have the cultural centers in town every day. You just kind of were like, well, I guess I have to wait for con season. So you save up all your money, and when
they get you on that money,
they do. Oh god, man. I could have.
You could own a home.
But we would always make sure to find one movie that we could all agree we're going to buy this. And it was usually cheap. It's not like we all chipped in like a little bit of money because it was only like $10 on DVD. And we would always pick one movie.
But you were teenagers. Like $10 is a lot of money. I remember trying to get, you know, a couple bucks for gas out of people when it was $10 to fill a tank.
Bingo. And one year we got this movie called The Machine Girl. Have you ever heard of The Machine Girl?
I don't think so.
Released in 2008 from Japan. The thing is, it basically tells the story of a girl whose family gets, you know, brutally murdered by Yakuza, and she gets her arm...
As happens.
As you do in Japan.
And, watch the trailer.
And she gets her arm sliced off and replaced eventually with a giant machine gun a la Planet Terror. Now,
I think I've seen the poster for this.
Yeah, and it's the girl. She's in like a Japanese school girl.
Yes, absolutely. I've seen the poster for this.
And it turns out it's a real movie. The thing is that, you know, Planet Terror came out a year before, and you can't, especially at the time we saw it, and we're like, okay, so is this just a riff on Planet Terror? Well, be that as it may, whether it is or isn't, it is so much better than Planet Terror. Yeah. It is balls out. They've got a drill bra. They've got a flying guillotine that finds people, attaches to their head, and just literally rips it off.
Oh, that's like the flying guillotine movie.
Wait, there's a...
I've never seen... Oh, it's an old... I believe...
Oh, you mean the Flying Guillotine movie.
Oh, shit. Flying Guillotine. Yeah, it's... I think it's a Shaw Brothers. It's a Kung Fu movie. I believe it's Shaw Brothers. It's one... A lot of those Kung Fu movies, like, you gotta... There's so many of them, you really kind of gotta... You gotta curate that. You gotta pick out the best ones.
You need
it's
the
all
gems.
It's all the same story. Somebody kills somebody's master, they go out for revenge.
Right.
But the Flying Guillotine, yeah, it's about this weapon... on a chain, goes on somebody's head,
just pops off.
It's probably inspired by that.
No doubt. And well, then,
oh, you'll love this. Then.
Now I'm going to have Flying Guillotine.
But it looked like the
Master
the Machine
of the Flying
Girl.
Guillotine.
I haven't seen the Machine Girl. It looked like it was a wireless version.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, this was on Bluetooth. Yeah.
Updated for the modern millennials.
The modern era.
The modern era.
It's not the steampunk version.
Yeah. No. So, yeah, that's what I would say. If you can find, I believe it is streaming on Amazon Prime. You can get the DVD for like $10. Maybe, I think I saw it on Amazon for 72 cents.
I'll have me and my friend chip in.
Who's got a quarter? But yeah, definitely find that one. All right, again, thank you so much.
This is fun. I love this is so much fun coming out with you guys.
Well, and I feel like every time you come here, I leave, I'm like, okay, I'll have some notes open.
Yeah, seriously.
And then I'm three pages in of just film titles and brief descriptions, such as, you know, just Orca, John Huston, Killer Whale, Blackfish prequel.
I think it's John Huston. Someone will tell me if I'm wrong.
Alligator, !! Sewers. So,
Chicago.
So, thank you again.
Oh, thank you for
Get out
me,
to these midnight movies. We're definitely going to see you at The Astrologer. I really got to get out and see Stray Cat Rock Sex
Hunter. Oh, yeah,
Hunter,
absolutely. Like, she is, like, if you look at her, Miko Kaji is, like, the first female action hero. Like, she's it.
And what was it, 1973?
That was 70. Snowblood was 73.
Yeah.
Okay. That's really, like... She's great in Stray Cat,
yeah.
But she's otherworldly in Lady Snowblood,
and
like nothing you've ever seen.
It's just lovely. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, all right.
I'd love to do it again soon.
Where can people follow you on social media?
Absolutely, you can find me on Twitter at Mike Vanderbilt. I'm on a race for 10,000 followers. I'm about at 9,200.
Very good.
So hey, follow me. Just follow. You don't need to
help a guy out.
Follow me and mute me. I don't care. Like retweet my stuff once in a while. You can also find me at Daily Grindhouse at Daily Grindhouse on dailygrindhouse.com, and then you can find me. I write about podcasts weekly. We're gonna work on getting this one on here at the AV Club on their Podmass, and I've been this week I had my debut. Go up at the Takeout, which is the AV Club's food and drink site.
I saw that.
Yeah, that was
for
recent.
Butter Week.
For Butter Week, yeah. It's like I joke that I've alienated everybody in film and television criticism, and I got a whole new crew of people to alienate in food and drink.
There you go.
And if you want to just hang out with me, you can find me at the Rock Island Public House Saturday nights down in beautiful downtown Blue Island behind the bar.
Fantastic. All right. Slinging it. All right. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I'm Tom Hush.
I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we will see you all next week.